algorithm as an indicator of high liquidity, prompting it to increase the rate at which it was putting E-mini contracts on the market, pushing the downward spiral. At some point, the high-frequency traders started withdrawing from the market, drying up liquidity while prices continued to fall. At 2:45 p.m., trading on the E-mini was halted by an automatic circuit breaker, the exchange's stop logic functionality. When trading was restarted a mere 5 seconds later, prices stabilized and soon began to recover most of the losses. But for a while, at the trough of the crisis, $1 trillion had been wiped off the market, and spillover effects had led to a substantial number of trades in individual securities being executed at absurd prices, such as 1 cent or $100,000. After the market closed for the day, representatives of the exchanges met with regulators and decided to break all trades that had been executed at prices 60% or more away from their pre-crisis levels, deeming such transactions clearly erroneous, and thus subject to post-facto cancellation under existing trade rules. The retelling here of this episode is a digression because the computer programs involved in the flash crash were not particularly intelligent or sophisticated, and the kind of threat they created is fundamentally different from the concerns we shall raise later in this book in relation to the prospect of machine superintelligence. Nevertheless, these events illustrate several useful lessons. One is the reminder that interactions between individually simple components, such as the cell algorithm and the high-frequency algorithmic trading programs, can produce complicated and unexpected effects. Systemic risk can build up in a system as new elements are introduced, risks that are not obvious until after something goes wrong, and sometimes not even then. Another lesson is that smart professionals might give an instruction to a program based on a sensible-seeming and normally sound assumption, e.g., that trading volume is a good measure of market liquidity, and that this can produce catastrophic results when the program continues to act on the instruction with ironclad logical consistency, even in the unanticipated situation where the assumption turns out to be invalid. The algorithm just does what it does, and unless it is a very special kind of algorithm, it does not care that we clasp our heads and gasp in dumbstruck horror at the absurd inappropriateness of its actions. This is a theme that we will encounter again. A third observation in relation to the flash crash is that while automation contributed to the incident, it also contributed to its resolution. The pre-programmed stop order logic, which suspended trading when prices moved too far out of whack, was set to execute automatically because it had been correctly anticipated that the triggering events could happen on a timescale too swift for humans to respond. The need for pre-installed and automatically executing safety functionality, as opposed to reliance on runtime human supervision, again foreshadows a theme that will be important in our discussion of machine superintelligence. Opinions about the future of machine intelligence. Progress on two major fronts towards a more solid statistical and information theoretic foundation for machine learning, on the one hand, and toward the practical and commercial success of various problem-specific or domain-specific applications on the other, has restored to AI research some of its lost prestige. There may, however, be a residual cultural effect on the AI community of its earlier history that makes many mainstream researchers reluctant to align themselves with over-grand ambition. Thus, Nils Nilsson, one of the old-timers in the field, complains that his present-day colleagues lack the boldness of spirit that propelled the pioneers of his own generation. Concern for respectability has had, I think, a stultifying effect on some AI researchers. I hear them saying things like, AI used to be criticized for its flossiness. Now that we have made solid progress, let us not risk losing our respectability. One result of this conservatism has been increased concentration on weak AI, the variety devoted to providing aids to human thought, and away from strong AI, the variety that attempts to mechanize human-level intelligence. Nilsson's sentiment has been echoed by several others of the founders, including Marvin Minsky, John McCarthy, and Patrick Winston. The last few years have seen a resurgence of interest in AI, which might yet spill over into renewed efforts towards artificial general intelligence, what Nilsson calls strong AI. In addition to faster hardware, a contemporary project would benefit from the great strides that have been made in the many subfields of AI, in software engineering more generally, and in neighboring fields such as computational neuroscience. One indication of pent-up demand for quality information in education is shown in the response to the free online offering of an introductory course in artificial intelligence at Stanford University in the fall of 2011, organized by Sebastian Thrun and Peter Norvig. Some 160,000 students from around the world signed up to take it, and 23,000 completed it. Expert opinions about the future of AI vary wildly. There is disagreement about timescales, as well as about what forms AI might eventually take. Predictions about the future development of artificial intelligence, one recent study noted, are as confident as they are diverse. Although the contemporary distribution of belief has not been very carefully measured, we can get a rough impression from various smaller surveys and informal observations. In particular, a series of recent surveys have polled members of several relevant expert communities on the question of when they expect human-level machine intelligence, HLMI, to be developed, defined as one that can carry out most human professions at least as well as a typical human. Results are shown in Table 2. The combined sample gave the following median estimate: 10% probability of HLMI by 2022, 50% probability by 2040, and 90% probability by 2075. Respondents were asked to premise their estimates on the assumption that human scientific activity continues without major negative disruption. These numbers should be taken with some grains of salt. Sample sizes are quite small and not necessarily representative of the general expert population. They are, however, in concordance with results from other surveys. The survey results are also in line with some recently published interviews with about 24 researchers in AI-related fields. For example, Niels Nilsson has spent a long and productive career working on problems in search, planning, knowledge representation, and robotics. He has authored textbooks in artificial intelligence, and he recently completed the most comprehensive history of the field written to date. When asked about arrival dates for HLMI, he offered the following opinion: 10% chance, 2030. 50% chance, 2050. 90% chance, 2100. Judging from the published interview transcripts, Professor Nielsen's probability distribution appears to be quite representative of many experts in the area, though again it must be emphasized that there is a wide spread of opinion. There are practitioners who are substantially more boosterish, confidently expecting HLMI in the 2020 to 2040 range, and others who are confident either that it will never happen or that it is indefinitely far off. In addition, some interviewees feel that the notion of a human level of artificial intelligence is ill-defined or misleading, or are for other reasons reluctant to go on record with a quantitative prediction. My own view is that the median numbers reported in the expert survey do not have enough probability mass on later arrival dates. A 10% probability of HLMI not having been developed by 2075, or even 2100, after conditionalizing on human scientific activity continuing without major negative disruption, seems too low. Historically, AI researchers have not had a strong record of being able to predict the rate of advances in their own field, or the shape that such advances would take. On the one hand, Some tasks, like chess playing, turned out to be achievable by means of surprisingly simple programs. And naysayers who claimed that machines would never be able to do this or that have repeatedly been proven wrong. On the other hand, the more typical errors among practitioners have been to underestimate the difficulties of getting a system to perform robustly on real-world tasks, and to overestimate the advantages of their own particular pet project or technique. The survey also asked two other questions of relevance to our inquiry. One inquired of respondents about how much longer they thought it would take to reach superintelligence, assuming human-level machine is first achieved. The results are in Table 3. Another question inquired what they thought would be the overall long-term impact for humanity of achieving human-level machine intelligence. The answers are summarized in Figure 2. My own views again differ somewhat from the opinions expressed in the survey. I assign a higher probability to superintelligence being created relatively soon after human-level machine intelligence. I also have a more polarized outlook on the consequences, thinking an extremely good or an extremely bad outcome to be somewhat more likely than a more balanced outcome. The reasons for this will become clear later in the book. Small sample sizes, selection biases, and above all, the inherent unreliability of the subjective opinions elicited mean that one should not read too much into these expert surveys and interviews. They do not let us draw any strong conclusion, but they do hint at a weak conclusion. They suggest that, at least in lieu of better data or analysis, it may be reasonable to believe that human-level machine intelligence has a fairly sizable chance of being developed by mid-century, and that it has a non-trivial chance of being developed considerably sooner or much later, that it might perhaps fairly soon thereafter result in superintelligence, and that a wide range of outcomes may have a significant chance of occurring, including extremely good outcomes, and outcomes that are as bad as human extinction. At the very least, they suggest that the topic is worth a closer look. Chapter 2. Paths to Superintelligence. Machines are currently far inferior to humans in general intelligence. Yet one day, we have suggested, they will be superintelligent. How do we get from here to there? This chapter explores several conceivable technological paths. We look at artificial intelligence, whole brain emulation, biological cognition, and human-machine interfaces, as well as networks and organizations. We evaluate their different degrees of plausibility as pathways to superintelligence. The existence of multiple paths increases the probability that the destination can be reached via at least one of them. We can tentatively define a superintelligence as any intellect that greatly exceeds the cognitive performance of humans in virtually all domains of interest. We will have more to say about the concept of superintelligence in the next chapter, where we will subject it to a kind of spectral analysis to distinguish some different possible forms of superintelligence. But for now, the rough characterization just given will suffice. Note that the definition is non-committal about how the superintelligence is implemented. It is also non-committal regarding qualia, whether a superintelligence would have subjective conscious experience might matter greatly for some questions, in particular for some moral questions. But our primary focus here is on the causal antecedents and consequences of superintelligence, not on the metaphysics of mind. The chess program Deep Fritz is not a superintelligence on this definition, since Fritz is only smart within the narrow domain of chess. Certain kinds of domain-specific superintelligence could, however, be important. When referring to superintelligent performance limited to a particular domain, we will note the restriction explicitly. For instance, an engineering superintelligence would be an intellect that vastly outperforms the best current human minds in the domain of engineering. Unless otherwise noted, we use the term to refer to systems that have a superhuman level of general intelligence. But how might we create superintelligence? Let us examine some possible paths. Artificial intelligence. Readers of this chapter must not expect a blueprint for programming an artificial general intelligence. No such blueprint exists yet, of course. And had I been in possession of such a blueprint, I most certainly would not have published it in a book. If the reasons for this are not immediately obvious, the arguments in subsequent chapters will make them clear. We can, however, discern some general features of the kind of system that would be required. It now seems clear that a capacity to learn would be an integral feature of the core design of a system intended to attain general intelligence, not something to be tacked on later as an extension or an afterthought. The same holds for the ability to deal effectively with uncertainty and probabilistic information. Some faculty for extracting useful concepts from sensory data and internal states, and for leveraging acquired concepts into flexible combinatorial representations for use in logical and intuitive reasoning, also likely belong among the core design features in a modern AI intended to attain general intelligence. The early, good old-fashioned artificial intelligence systems did not, for the most part, focus on learning, uncertainty, or concept formation. Perhaps because techniques for dealing with these dimensions were poorly developed at the time. This is not to say that the underlying ideas are all that novel. The idea of using learning as a means of bootstrapping a simpler system to human-level intelligence can be traced back at least to Alan Turing's notion of a child machine, which he wrote about in 1950. Instead of trying to produce a program to simulate the adult mind, why not rather try to produce one which simulates the child's? If this were then subjected to an appropriate course of education, one would obtain the adult brain. Turing envisaged an iterative process to develop such a child machine. We cannot expect to find a good child machine at the first attempt. One must experiment with teaching one such machine and see how well it learns. One can then try another and see if it is better or worse. There is an obvious connection between this process and evolution. One may hope, however, that this process will be more expeditious than evolution. The survival of the fittest is a slow method for measuring advantages. The experimenter, by the exercise of intelligence, should be able to speed it up. Equally important is the fact that he is not restricted to random mutations. If he can trace a cause for some weakness, he can probably think of the kind of mutation which will improve it. We know that blind evolutionary processes can produce human-level general intelligence, since they have already done so at least once. Evolutionary processes with foresight, that is, genetic programs designed and guided by an intelligent human programmer, should be able to achieve a similar outcome with far greater efficiency. This observation has been used by some philosophers and scientists, including David Chalmers and Hans Moravec, to argue that human-level AI is not only theoretically possible, but feasible within this century. The idea is that we can estimate the relative capabilities of evolution and human engineering to produce intelligence, and find that human engineering is already vastly superior to evolution in some areas, and is likely to become superior in the remaining areas before too long. The fact that evolution produced intelligence therefore indicates that human engineering will soon be able to do the same. Thus, Moravec wrote already back in 1976, "The existence of several examples of intelligence designed under these constraints should give us great confidence that we can achieve the same in short order. The situation is analogous to the history of heavier-than-air flight, where birds, bats, and insects clearly demonstrated the possibility before our culture mastered it." One needs to be cautious, though, in what inferences one draws from this line of reasoning. It is true that evolution produced heavier-than-air flight, and that human engineers subsequently succeeded in doing likewise, albeit by means of a very different mechanism. Other examples could also be adduced, such as sonar, magnetic navigation, chemical weapons, photoreceptors, and all kinds of mechanic and kinetic performance characteristics. However, one could equally point to areas where human engineers have thus far failed to match evolution. In morphogenesis, self-repair, and the immune defense, for example, human efforts lag far behind what nature has accomplished. Moravec's argument, therefore, cannot give us great confidence that we can achieve human-level artificial intelligence in short order. At best, the evolution of intelligent life places an upper bound on the intrinsic difficulty of designing intelligence, but this upper bound could be quite far above current human engineering capabilities. Another way of deploying an evolutionary argument for the feasibility of AI is via the idea that we could, by running genetic algorithms on sufficiently fast computers, achieve results comparable to those of biological evolution. This version of the evolutionary argument thus proposes a specific method whereby intelligence could be produced. But is it true that we will soon have computing power sufficient to recapitulate the relevant evolutionary processes that produced human intelligence? The answer depends both on how much computing technology will advance over the next decades and on how much computing power would be required to run genetic algorithms with the same optimization power as the evolutionary process of natural selection that lies in our past. Although, in the end, the conclusion we get from pursuing this line of reasoning is disappointingly indeterminate, it is instructive to attempt a rough estimate. See Box 3. If nothing else, the exercise draws attention to some interesting unknowns. The upshot is that the computational resources required to simply replicate the relevant evolutionary processes on Earth that produced human-level intelligence are severely out of reach, and will remain so even if Moore's law were to continue for a century. Compare Figure 3. It is plausible, however, that compared with brute force replication of natural evolutionary processes, vast efficiency gains are achievable by designing the search process to aim for intelligence, using various obvious improvements over natural selection. Yet it is very hard to bound the magnitude of those attainable efficiency gains. We cannot even say whether they amount to 5 or to 25 orders of magnitude. Absent further elaboration, therefore, evolutionary arguments are not able to meaningfully constrain our expectations of either the difficulty of building human-level machine intelligence or the timescales for such developments. There is a further complication with these kinds of evolutionary considerations, one that makes it hard to derive from them even a very loose upper bound on the difficulty of evolving intelligence. We must avoid the error of inferring, from the fact that intelligent life evolved on Earth, that the evolutionary processes involved had a reasonably high prior probability of producing intelligence. Such an inference is unsound, because it fails to take account of the observation selection effect that guarantees that all observers will find themselves having originated on a planet where intelligent life arose, no matter how likely or unlikely it was for any given such planet to produce intelligence. Suppose, for example, that in addition to the systematic effects of natural selection, it required an enormous amount of lucky coincidence to produce intelligent life. Enough so that intelligent life evolves on only one planet out of every 10^30 planets on which simple replicators arise. In that case, when we run our genetic algorithms to try to replicate what natural evolution did, we might find that we must run some 10^30 simulations before we find one where all the elements come together in just the right way. This seems fully consistent with our observation that life did evolve here on Earth. Only by careful and somewhat intricate reasoning, by analyzing instances of convergent evolution of intelligence-related traits, and engaging with the subtleties of observation selection theory, can we partially circumvent this epistemological barrier. Unless one takes the trouble to do so, one is not in a position to rule out the possibility that the alleged upper bound on the computational requirements for recapitulating the evolution of intelligence derived in Box 3 might be too low by 30 orders of magnitude, or some other such large number. Another way of arguing for the feasibility of artificial intelligence is by pointing to the human brain and suggesting that we could use it as a template for a machine intelligence. One can distinguish different versions of this approach based on how closely they propose to imitate biological brain functions. At one extreme, that of very close imitation, we have the idea of whole brain emulation, which we will discuss in the next subsection. At the other extreme are approaches that take their inspiration from the functioning of the brain, but do not attempt low-level imitation. Advances in neuroscience and cognitive psychology, which will be aided by improvements in instrumentation, should eventually uncover the general principles of brain function. This knowledge could then guide AI efforts. We have already encountered neural networks as an example of a brain-inspired AI technique. Hierarchical perceptual organization is another idea that has been transferred from brain science to machine learning. The study of reinforcement learning has been motivated, at least in part, by its role in psychological theories of animal cognition, and reinforcement learning techniques, e.g. the TD algorithm, inspired by these theories, are now widely used in AI. More cases like these will surely accumulate in the future. Since there is a limited number, perhaps a very small number, of distinct, fundamental mechanisms that operate in the brain, continuing incremental progress in brain science should eventually discover them all. Before this happens, though, it is possible that a hybrid approach, combining some brain-inspired techniques with some purely artificial methods, would cross the finishing line. In that case, the resultant system need not be recognizably brain-like, even though some brain-derived insights were used in its development. The availability of the brain as template provides strong support for the claim that machine intelligence is ultimately feasible. This, however, does not enable us to predict when it will be achieved, because it is hard to predict the future rate of discoveries in brain science. What we can say is that the further into the future we look, the greater the likelihood that the secrets of the brain's functionality will have been decoded sufficiently to enable the creation of machine intelligence in this manner. Different people working toward machine intelligence hold different views about how promising neuromorphic approaches are compared with approaches that aim for completely synthetic designs. The existence of birds demonstrated that heavier-than-air flight was physically possible and prompted efforts to build flying machines. Yet the first functioning airplanes did not flap their wings. The jury is out on whether machine intelligence will be like flight, which humans achieved through an artificial mechanism, or like combustion, which we initially mastered by copying naturally occurring fires. Turing's idea of designing a program that acquires most of its content by learning, rather than having it pre-programmed at the outset, can apply equally to neuromorphic and synthetic approaches to machine intelligence. A variation on Turing's conception of a child machine is the idea of a seed AI. Whereas a child machine, as Turing seems to have envisaged it, would have a relatively fixed architecture that simply develops its inherent potentialities by accumulating content, a seed AI would be a more sophisticated artificial intelligence capable of improving its own architecture. In the early stages of a seed AI, such improvements might occur mainly through trial and error, information acquisition, or assistance from the programmers. At its later stages, however, a seed AI should be able to understand its own working sufficiently to engineer new algorithms and computational structures to bootstrap its cognitive performance. This needed understanding could result from the seed AI reaching a sufficient level of general intelligence across many domains, or from crossing some threshold in a particularly relevant domain, such as computer science or mathematics. This brings us to another important concept, that of recursive self-improvement. A successful seed AI would be able to iteratively enhance itself. An early version of the AI could design an improved version of itself, and the improved version, being smarter than the original, might be able to design an even smarter version of itself, and so forth. Under some conditions, such a process of recursive self-improvement might continue long enough to result in an intelligence explosion, an event in which, in a short period of time, a system's level of intelligence increases from a relatively modest endowment of cognitive capabilities, perhaps subhuman in most respects, but with a domain-specific talent for coding and AI research, to radical superintelligence. We will return to this important possibility in Chapter 4, where the dynamics of such an event will be analyzed more closely. Note that this model suggests the possibility of surprises. Attempts to build artificial general intelligence might fail pretty much completely until the last missing critical component is put in place, at which point a seed AI might become capable of sustained recursive self-improvement. Before we end this subsection, there is one more thing that we should emphasize, which is that an artificial intelligence need not much resemble a human mind. AIs could be, indeed, it is likely that most will be, extremely alien. We should expect that they will have very different cognitive architectures than biological intelligences, and in their early stages of development, they will have very different profiles of cognitive strengths and weaknesses, though, as we shall later argue, they could eventually overcome any initial weakness. Furthermore, the goal systems of AIs could diverge radically from those of human beings. There is no reason to expect a generic AI to be motivated by love or hate or pride or other such common human sentiments. These complex adaptations would require deliberate, expensive effort to recreate in AIs. This is at once a big problem and a big opportunity. We will return to the issue of AI motivation in later chapters, but it is so central to the argument in this book that it is worth bearing in mind throughout. Box 3. What would it take to recapitulate evolution? Not every feat accomplished by evolution in the course of the development of human intelligence is relevant to a human engineer trying to artificially evolve machine intelligence. Only a small portion of evolutionary selection on Earth has been selection for intelligence. More specifically, the problems that human engineers cannot trivially bypass may have been the target of a very small portion of total evolutionary selection. For example, since we can run our computers on electrical power, we do not have to reinvent the molecules of the cellular energy economy in order to create intelligent machines. Yet such molecular evolution of metabolic pathways might have used up a large part of the total amount of selection power that was available to evolution over the course of Earth's history. One might argue that the key insights for AI are embodied in the structure of nervous systems, which came into existence less than a billion years ago. If we take that view, then the number of relevant experiments available to evolution is drastically curtailed. There are some 4 to 6 times 10 to the power of 30 prokaryotes in the world today, but only 10 to the power of 19 insects, and fewer than 10 to the power of 10 humans, while pre-agricultural populations were orders of magnitude smaller. These numbers are only moderately intimidating. Evolutionary algorithms, however, require not only variations to select among, but also a fitness function to evaluate variance, and this is typically the most computationally expensive component. A fitness function for the evolution of artificial intelligence plausibly requires simulation of neural development, learning, and cognition to evaluate fitness. We might thus do better not to look at the raw number of organisms with complex nervous systems, but instead to attend to the number of neurons in biological organisms that we might need to simulate to mimic evolution's fitness function. We can make a crude estimate of that latter quantity by considering insects, which dominate terrestrial animal biomass, with ants alone estimated to contribute some 15 to 20%. Insect brain size varies substantially, with large and social insects sporting larger brains. A honeybee brain has just under 10^6 neurons. A fruit fly brain has 10^5 neurons, and ants are in between with 250,000 neurons. The majority of smaller insects may have brains of only a few thousand neurons. Erring on the side of conservatively high, if we assigned all 10^19 insects fruit fly numbers of neurons, the total would be 10^24 insect neurons in the world. This could be augmented with an additional order of magnitude to account for aquatic copepods, birds, reptiles, mammals, etc., to reach 10^25. By contrast, in pre-agricultural times, there were fewer than 10^7 humans, with under 10^11 neurons each, thus fewer than 10^18 human neurons in total, though humans have a higher number of synapses per neuron. The computational cost of simulating one neuron depends on the level of detail that one includes in the simulation. Extremely simple neuron models use about 1,000 floating point operations per second, FLOPS, to simulate one neuron in real time. The electrophysiologically realistic Hodgkin-Huxley model uses 1,200,000 FLOPS. A more detailed multi-compartmental model would add another 3 to 4 orders of magnitude, while higher-level models that abstract systems of neurons could subtract 2 to 3 orders of magnitude from the simple models. If we were to simulate 10^25 neurons over 1 billion years of evolution, longer than the existence of nervous systems as we know them, and we allow our computers to run for 1 year, these figures would give us a requirement in the range of 10^31 to 10^44 FLOPS. For comparison, China's Tianhe 2, the world's most powerful supercomputer as of September 2013, provides only 3.39 times 10^16 FLOPS. In recent decades, it has taken approximately 6.7 years for commodity computers to increase in power by one order of magnitude. Even a century of continued Moore's law would not be enough to close this gap. Running more specialized hardware or allowing longer run times could contribute only a few more orders of magnitude. This figure is conservative in another respect. Evolution achieved human intelligence without aiming at this outcome. In other words, the fitness functions for natural organisms do not select only for intelligence and its precursors. Even environments in which organisms with superior information processing skills reap various rewards may not select for intelligence, because improvements to intelligence can, and often do, impose significant costs, such as higher energy consumption or slower maturation times, and those costs may outweigh whatever benefits are gained from smarter behavior. Excessively deadly environments also reduce the value of intelligence. The shorter one's expected lifespan, the less time there will be for increased learning ability to pay off. Reduced selective pressure for intelligence slows the spread of intelligence-enhancing innovations, and thus the opportunity for selection to favor subsequent innovations that depend on them. Furthermore, evolution may wind up stuck in local optima that humans would notice and bypass by altering trade-offs between exploitation and exploration, or by providing a smooth progression of increasingly difficult intelligence tests. And as mentioned earlier, evolution scatters much of its selection power on traits that are unrelated to intelligence, such as Red Queen's races of competitive coevolution between immune systems and parasites. Evolution continues to waste resources producing mutations that have proved consistently lethal, and it fails to take advantage of statistical similarities in the effects of different mutations. These are all inefficiencies in natural selection, when viewed as a means of evolving intelligence, that it would be relatively easy for a human engineer to avoid while using evolutionary algorithms to develop intelligent software. It is plausible that eliminating inefficiencies like those just described would trim many orders of magnitude off the 10 to the power of 31 to 10 to the power of 44 FLOPS range calculated earlier. Unfortunately, it is difficult to know how many orders of magnitude. It is difficult even to make a rough estimate. For aught we know, the efficiency savings could be 5 orders of magnitude, or 10, or 25. Whole brain emulation. In whole brain emulation, also known as uploading, intelligent software would be produced by scanning and closely modeling the computational structure of a biological brain. This approach thus represents a limiting case of drawing inspiration from nature, barefaced plagiarism. Achieving whole brain emulation requires the accomplishment of the following steps. First, a sufficiently detailed scan of a particular human brain is created. This might involve stabilizing the brain post-mortem through vitrification, a process that turns tissue into a kind of glass. A machine could then dissect the tissue into thin slices, which could be fed into another machine for scanning, perhaps by an array of electron microscopes. Various stains might be applied at this stage to bring out different structural and chemical properties. Many scanning machines could work in parallel to process multiple brain slices simultaneously. Second, the raw data from the scanners is fed to a computer for automated image processing to reconstruct the three-dimensional neuronal network that implemented cognition in the original brain. In practice, this step might proceed concurrently with the first step to reduce the amount of high-resolution image data stored in buffers. The resulting map is then combined with a library of neurocomputational models of different types of neurons or of different neuronal elements, such as particular kinds of synaptic connectors. Figure 4 shows some results of scanning and image processing produced with present-day technology. In the third stage, the neurocomputational structure resulting from the previous step is implemented on a sufficiently powerful computer. If completely successful, the result would be a digital reproduction of the original intellect, with memory and personality intact. The emulated human mind now exists as software on a computer. The mind can either inhabit a virtual reality or interface with the external world by means of robotic appendages. The whole brain emulation path does not require that we figure out how human cognition works or how to program an artificial intelligence. It requires only that we understand the low-level functional characteristics of the basic computational elements of the brain. No fundamental conceptual or theoretical breakthrough is needed for whole brain emulation to succeed. Whole brain emulation does, however, require some rather advanced enabling technologies. There are 3 key prerequisites. 1. Scanning. High-throughput microscopy with sufficient resolution and detection of relevant properties. 2. Translation. Automated image analysis to turn raw scanning data into an interpreted three-dimensional model or relevant neurocomputational elements. And 3. Simulation. Hardware powerful enough to implement the resultant computational structure. See Table 4. In comparison with these more challenging steps, the construction of a basic virtual reality or a robotic embodiment with an audio-visual input channel and some simple output channel is relatively easy. Simple yet minimally adequate input-output seems feasible already with present technology. There is good reason to think that the requisite enabling technologies are attainable, though not in the near future. Reasonable computational models of many types of neuron and neuronal processes already exist. Image recognition software has been developed that can trace axons and dendrites through a stack of two-dimensional images, though reliability needs to be improved. And there are imaging tools that provide the necessary resolution. With a scanning tunneling microscope, it is possible to see individual atoms, which is a far higher resolution than needed. However, although present knowledge and capabilities suggest that there is no in-principle barrier to the development of the requisite enabling technologies, it is clear that a very great deal of incremental technical progress will be needed to bring human whole-brain emulation within reach. For example, microscopy technology would need not just sufficient resolution, but also sufficient throughput. Using an atomic resolution scanning tunneling microscope to image the needed surface area would be far too slow to be practicable. It would be more plausible to use a lower resolution electron microscope, but this would require new methods for preparing and staining cortical tissue to make visible relevant details such as synaptic fine structure. A great expansion of neurocomputational libraries and major improvements in automated image processing and scan interpretation would also be needed. In general, whole brain emulation relies less on theoretical insight and more on technological capability than artificial intelligence. Just how much technology is required for whole brain emulation depends on the level of abstraction at which the brain is emulated. In this regard, there is a trade-off between insight and technology. In general, the worse our scanning equipment and the feebler our computers, the less we could rely on simulating low-level chemical and electrophysiological brain processes, and the more theoretical understanding would be needed of the computational architecture that we are seeking to emulate in order to create more abstract representations of the relevant functionalities. Conversely, with sufficiently advanced scanning technology and abundant computing power, it might be possible to brute force an emulation even with a fairly limited understanding of the brain. In the unrealistic limiting case, we could imagine emulating a brain at the level of its elementary particles using the quantum mechanical Schrödinger equation. Then one could rely entirely on existing knowledge of physics and not at all on any biological model. This extreme case, however, would place utterly impracticable demands on computational power and data acquisition. A far more plausible level of emulation would be one that incorporates individual neurons and their connectivity matrix, along with some of the structure of their dendritic trees, and maybe some state variables of individual synapses. Neurotransmitter molecules would not be simulated individually, but their fluctuating concentrations will be modeled in a coarse-grained manner. To assess the feasibility of whole-brain emulation, one must understand the criterion for success. The aim is not to create a brain simulation so detailed and accurate that one could use it to predict exactly what would have happened in the original brain if it had been subjected to a particular sequence of stimuli. Instead, the aim is to capture enough of the computationally functional properties of the brain to enable the resultant emulation to perform intellectual work. For this purpose, much of the messy biological detail of a real brain is irrelevant. A more elaborate analysis would distinguish between different levels of emulation success based on the extent to which the information processing functionality of the emulated brain has been preserved. For example, one could distinguish among 1, a high-fidelity emulation that has the full set of knowledge, skills, capacities, and values of the emulated brain. 2, a distorted emulation, whose dispositions are significantly non-human in some ways, but which is mostly able to do the same intellectual labor as the emulated brain. And 3, a generic emulation, which might also be distorted. That is somewhat like an infant, lacking the skills or memories that had been acquired by the emulated adult brain, but with the capacity to learn most of what a normal human can learn. While it appears ultimately feasible to produce a high-fidelity emulation, it seems quite likely that the first whole-brain emulation that we would achieve if we went down this path, would be of a lower grade. Before we would get things to work perfectly, we would probably get things to work imperfectly. It is also possible that a push towards emulation technology would lead to the creation of some kind of neuromorphic AI that would adapt some neurocomputational principles discovered during emulation efforts and hybridize them with synthetic methods, and that this would happen before the completion of a fully functional whole-brain emulation. The possibility of such a spillover into neuromorphic AI, as we shall see in a later chapter, complicates the strategic assessment of the desirability of seeking to expedite emulation technology. How far are we currently from achieving a human whole-brain emulation? One recent assessment presented a technical roadmap and concluded that the prerequisite capabilities might be available around mid-century, though with a large uncertainty interval. Figure 5 depicts the major milestones in this roadmap. The apparent simplicity of the map may be deceptive, however, and we should be careful not to understate how much work remains to be done. No brain has yet been emulated. Consider the humble model organism, Caenorhabditis elegans, which is a transparent roundworm about 1 millimeter in length, with 302 neurons. The complete connectivity matrix of these neurons has been known since the mid-1980s, when it was laboriously mapped out by means of slicing, electron microscopy, and hand-labeling of specimens. But knowing merely which neurons are connected with which is not enough. To create a brain emulation, one would also need to know which synapses are excitatory and which are inhibitory, the strength of the connections, and various dynamical properties of axons, synapses, and dendritic trees. This information is not yet available, even for the small nervous system of Caenorhabditis elegans, although it may now be within range of a targeted, moderately sized research project. Success at emulating a tiny brain, such as that of Caenorhabditis elegans, would give us a better view of what it would take to emulate larger brains. At some point in the technology development process, once techniques are available for automatically emulating small quantities of brain tissue, the problem reduces to one of scaling. Notice the ladder at the right side of Figure 5. This ascending series of boxes represents a final sequence of advances which can commence after preliminary hurdles have been cleared. The stages in this sequence correspond to whole brain emulations of successively more neurologically sophisticated model organisms. For example, Caenorhabditis elegans goes to honeybee, goes to mouse, goes to rhesus monkey, goes to human. Because the gaps between these rungs, at least after the first step, are mostly quantitative in nature, and due mainly, though not entirely, to the differences in size of the brains to be emulated, they should be tractable through a relatively straightforward scale-up of scanning and simulation capacity. Once we start ascending this final ladder, the eventual attainment of human whole-brain emulation becomes more clearly foreseeable. We can thus expect to get some advance warning before arrival at human-level machine intelligence along the whole-brain emulation path, at least if the last among the requisite enabling technologies to reach sufficient maturity is either high-throughput scanning or the computational power needed for real-time simulation. If, however, the last enabling technology to fall into place is neurocomputational modeling, then the transition from unimpressive prototypes to a working human emulation could be more abrupt. One could imagine a scenario in which, despite abundant scanning data and fast computers, it is proving difficult to get our neuronal models to work right. When finally the last glitch is ironed out, what was previously a completely dysfunctional system, analogous perhaps to an unconscious brain undergoing a grand mal seizure, might snap into a coherent, wakeful state. In this case, the key advance would not be heralded by a series of functioning animal emulations of increasing magnitude. provoking newspaper headlines of correspondingly escalating font size. Even for those paying attention, it might be difficult to tell in advance of success just how many flaws remained in the neurocomputational models at any point, and how long it would take to fix them, even up to the eve of the critical breakthrough. Once a human whole-brain emulation has been achieved, further, potentially explosive developments would take place. But we postpone discussion of this until Chapter 4. Surprise scenarios are thus imaginable for whole-brain emulation, even if all the relevant research were conducted in the open. Nevertheless, compared with the AI path to machine intelligence, whole-brain emulation is more likely to be preceded by clear omens, since it relies more on concrete observable technologies and is not wholly based on theoretical insight. We can also say, with greater confidence than for the AI path, that the emulation path will not succeed in the near future, within the next 15 years, say, because we know that several challenging precursor technologies have not yet been developed. By contrast, it seems likely that somebody could, in principle, sit down and code a seed AI on an ordinary present-day personal computer. And it is conceivable, though unlikely, that somebody somewhere will get the right insight for how to do this in the near future. Biological cognition. A third path to greater than current human intelligence is to enhance the functioning of biological brains. In principle, this could be achieved without technology through selective breeding. Any attempt to initiate a classical large-scale eugenics program, however, would confront major political and moral hurdles. Moreover, unless the selection were extremely strong, many generations would be required to produce substantial results. Long before such an initiative would bear fruit, advances in biotechnology will allow much more direct control of human genetics and neurobiology, rendering OTOs any human breeding program. We will therefore focus on methods that hold the potential to deliver results faster, on the timescale of a few generations or less. Our individual cognitive capacities can be strengthened in various ways, including by such traditional methods as education and training. Neurological development can be promoted by low-tech interventions, such as optimizing maternal and infant nutrition, removing lead and other neurotoxic pollutants from the environment, eradicating parasites, ensuring adequate sleep and exercise, and preventing diseases that affect the brain. Improvements in cognition can certainly be obtained through each of these means, though the magnitudes of the gains are likely to be modest, especially in populations that are already reasonably well-nourished and schooled. We will certainly not achieve superintelligence by any of these means, but they might help on the margin, particularly by lifting up the deprived and expanding the catchment of global talent. Lifelong depression of intelligence due to iodine deficiency remains widespread in many impoverished inland areas of the world. An outrage, given that the condition can be prevented by fortifying table salt at a cost of a few cents per person and year. Biomedical enhancements could give bigger boosts. Drugs already exist that are alleged to improve memory, concentration, and mental energy in at least some subjects. Work on this book was fueled by coffee and nicotine chewing gum. While the efficacy of the present generation of smart drugs is variable, marginal, and generally dubious, future nootropics might offer clearer benefits and fewer side effects. However, it seems implausible on both neurological and evolutionary grounds that one could, by introducing some chemical into the brain of a healthy person, spark a dramatic rise in intelligence. The cognitive functioning of a human brain depends on a delicate orchestration of many factors, especially during the critical stages of embryo development. And it is much more likely that this self-organizing structure, to be enhanced, needs to be carefully balanced, tuned, and cultivated, rather than simply flooded with some extraneous potion. Manipulation of genetics will provide a more powerful set of tools than psychopharmacology. Consider again the idea of genetic selection. Instead of trying to implement a eugenics program by controlling mating patterns, one